Morning, everybody. Today will be the fourth and final of the lessons on fear. And as I have said for the last 4 weeks, the commandment to not be afraid is really the one of the most repeated commandments in all of Scripture. But it's not a command to never be afraid, to never feel fear. Paul talks about himself struggling in 2 Corinthians with fear and having fear inside. It's not that we were created by God to have a fear response, but he is teaching us to overcome fear and not act out of fear. And so, as Paul wrote to Timothy in 2 Timothy 3, or in chapter 1, in verse 7, he says, "For God gave us a spirit not of fear, but of power and love and self-control." And so, God does not want us to have a spirit of fear. We might feel it, we might react it, you know, and have kind of a feeling of fear, but he wants us to think it through. He wants us to respond not out of fear, but out of godliness and righteousness. And so I'm going to just remind us a little bit of what we've talked about in the previous few weeks. I went and started this whole series with looking at his instructions for the disciples. When he sent out the 12 and told them to go throughout Israel and preach, he actually, not only telling them to go and proclaim the kingdom and heal the sick and do miracles and all those things, but he said, if they don't listen, to move on. And then he told them, you're going to be persecuted. And they're going to try you and they're going to flog you. But don't be anxious about defending yourself. So don't worry and don't be afraid of that. He said, they're going to hate you like they did the master. And when they persecute you, he told them to flee. Told them to go to the next town. And so as I talked about a couple of weeks ago, there is a time to run. There's a time when we're afraid to leave. But then there's also a time to not be afraid. And so even though he told them to flee, he also told them, don't be afraid of those who can kill the body. Only fear him who can destroy both body and soul. And so he told them to go out, to not be afraid, and to acknowledge Jesus. And then he said in the very last few verses of that whole section, he says, don't think I came to bring peace on earth and to solve all the conflict between people. He came to bring peace between man and God, but a lot of people don't want that peace. And when they don't want that peace, they're not going to be a part of that peace. And there will be conflict. And some of that conflict happens even between family members. And he says, if you try to save your life, you will lose it. Stand up for Jesus' sake, even to the death of the body. So those are all of my summations of all of his teaching in that chapter. But kind of moving on to what I talked about a couple of weeks ago, there is a time to flee, but not from fear. And when he told them that, to run away, and I highlighted this verse for you at the time in Ecclesiastes 9, verse 4, which talks about this problem that everybody faces death, both the good and the bad. There's no way we can avoid death. He says, but he who is joined with all the living have hope. And so sometimes we want to still have hope. Sometimes we're still working for hope. But he said, a living dog is better than a dead lion. Mm-hmm. And so that little proverb, that little saying given in Ecclesiastes 9 is an important one for us to understand that sometimes we run because it's better that we're a living dog in the moment. Paul himself, when he talked about facing death a number of different times, one of the earlier times he faced death when he didn't expect to die, but he did say, you know, he was kind of hard pressed. He would prefer for himself to be killed and to go to heaven and to have that gain, to have that blessing. But he said, for their sake, it would be better for him to stay behind so that he could teach the gospel to them. And so he was kind of pressed. He's like, well, it's better for you if I stay, but better for me if I go. Well, the Lord will decide ultimately, but he understood both those things. And sometimes It's better that we stay behind. Now, in 26 through 33, which I talked about a bit last week, don't be afraid of those who can kill the body. And he said, and this is kind of a reminder, I didn't use this verse last week, but I thought I'd throw it out there. 1 Peter 3, 13 and 14, Peter also talks about this concept a little bit. Now, who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? So that's kind of a rhetorical question. So normally, if you do what's good and righteous and godly, you're not going to be harmed. You're not going to be hurt. But that's not an all the time thing. And he says, but even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled. Now you can go on reading past that. For space, I just put up those couple of verses. But he talks about, don't be afraid. He even goes on, be prepared to give a defense, you know, for the hope that is in you. That's 1 Peter 3:15. And so, as he's telling us to go out, to be godly, to be patient and kind and gentle, he's also telling us to not be afraid, to overcome the fear. To overcome the fear of being attacked or persecuted or hated. Because it's going to happen. There's no way to avoid it. There's no way to avoid ever being afraid. What he wants us to avoid is making decisions based on fear. He wants us to make decisions based on godliness and righteousness that are not trying to save our bodies, but save our souls. And not only our souls, but the souls of others. And sometimes we get caught up and forget and begin to love this present world. As I mentioned last week, that we see that the comment that Paul made about Demas, a brother in Christ in the first century, who had been somebody who went out and worked. But he said, Paul did in his very last letter, not long before he was killed and executed, that Demas had forsaken him. He had left him because he loved this present world. Demas had tried to save his own life, apparently. And so this brother, who is spoken well of by Paul in other places, at a moment when he should have stood with Paul, he didn't. Now, Paul comments on that. And so there is a time for us to stand up and to face the fear and to do the right thing, even if it costs us our life. And that's hard to do, facing that danger. And this is a Proverb 28, verse 1 I talked about also last week. The wicked flee when no one pursues. So sometimes the wicked, they're afraid even when there's nothing actually attacking them. But the righteous are as bold as a lion, he said. Now, sometimes being a bold lion also means being a dead lion, as Ecclesiastes 9:4 talks about. And I talked about a couple weeks ago the importance of a dead lion. In fact, even though Ecclesiastes 9:4 says, you know, a living dog, you know, it's better to be a living dog than a dead lion. You and I, our only hope is in a dead lion. Jesus, who is called the Lion of the Tribe of Judah, had to face his death and be killed for you and I to have hope. And so there is a time to be the lion even when it costs you your life. But it's hard to know the difference between those. This is where judgment comes in. This is where, you know, we shouldn't be looking at each other and deciding for others. All of us are going to have to give an account of our own judgments. And each of us needs to make our own judgments in these matters. And each of us, we should not be judging others in regards to this. And their judgment of whether they should run or whether they should stand. Now, the question that really arose to me, though, is how. And we're going to look at 2 Corinthians chapter 4, end of chapter 4 and beginning of 5. Because I started thinking months ago, and I've been thinking about this idea for a while, and I've been kind of reading through a lot of scriptures for a fairly long time. You know, The last year of the pandemic hopefully has taught us some lessons. Hopefully we've learned some things about ourselves, about others, about the world, about a whole slew of things. But one of them is fear. Lots of fear in the world. A lot of fear, a lot of reactions out of fear. And so I started thinking about it, talking about it, and with others, and reading a lot about it, even, you know, just kind of what psychologists think about fear and how fear kind of gets, how the fear reaction happens in the body, and all kinds of different things. And I started thinking, well, how do we overcome fear? How do we overcome the natural fear response that we get in certain situations? How do we overcome that? And I started, and I came up with a lot of, there are a lot of little things, but then I realized as I was reading this passage that it really all comes to this, and this is actually what the scriptures tell us, that really, in fact, the only way we overcome fear of all the different things that might happen to us in this world is if we're not afraid to die. Not every fearful situation means we're going to die, but ultimately the only way I think scriptures that I found in the end, because all the different tricks and things to overcome fear, if at a certain point you're afraid to die, like Demas, something can cause you to act in fear. And ultimately, the only way to not act in fear is to not be afraid to die. And so, let's look at these passages. And so, as I, in verses 7 through 18 of chapter 4, he says, "But we have this treasure in jars of clay, to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you. Since we have the same spirit of faith, according to what has been written, 'I believed and so I spoke.' We also believe and so we also speak, knowing that he who raised the Lord Jesus will raise us also with Jesus and bring us with you into his presence. For it is all for your sake, so that as grace extends to more and more people, it may increase thanksgiving to the glory of God. So, and this is important, so we have this treasure in jars of clay, and even though we're perplexed and we're afflicted and we're distressed, we don't lose heart, he says. And even though our outer self, this body, this flesh, is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. As we look not to the things that are seen, but the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal." And so this light momentary affliction may even be those things that lead to death. They may even be things where people are imprisoned for long periods of time before they're killed. Light and momentary affliction, from a human perspective, for most of us, if we were to be lightly and momentarily afflicted for one full day, we would feel pretty feel hard, right? What about a week? Can you handle it a week? What about a month? What about a few years? But even 5 years, in the concept that God is trying to get us to see of what he has promised us and what he wants to deliver to us, that even years of light, momentary affliction, God's words, you and I would say, difficulties we can barely stand. And why is it light and momentary from God's perspective? Because he has an understanding of what happens beyond. You and I don't have any experience with what's beyond. So all the affliction that we deal with in this life, and especially when it's hard and been some of the hardest you've ever had, it doesn't feel light. But from God's perspective and from the gospel's perspective, no matter what we endure in this world, it is a light, momentary affliction compared with the glory that has been prepared for us. Jesus himself told his own disciples, "I'm going away to prepare a place for you, that where I am, you may be also." And so he gave them that hope and that promise that they could overcome the fear of death, because all of them were going to have to face not only persecution and floggings, but death. And they were going to have to do it in a godly way, in a faithful way, in a gracious way, in a comfortable or comforting and kind and good and patient. Those things are hard to do when people are hurting you, aren't it? Isn't it? But they had to do that just like Jesus did. Just like Timothy did. It's not like the early Christians didn't learn how to do it as well. And so, he says, we have this treasure of the gospel in these jars of clay, but we don't lose heart. Because this is a light, momentary affliction compared with what the glory that is waiting for us. And then he says in chapter 5, "For," and that word could be translated "because," and why don't we lose heart? "Because we know that if the tent that is our earthly home is destroyed," that tent is this body he's talking about. That term tent, by the way, means a temporary dwelling. You put up a tent when you go camping, right? I don't know how many of you love to camp. How long do you like to camp for? 5 years? Would 5 years of camping be a light, momentary affliction? But that's what we are. We are camping. Understand, living in this world is camping. The homes we build to live in are not really our homes. They're part of the tent. They're just a place to put our tent. It's a little bit like going, you know, to a prepared campground, right? Where they've leveled it all out for you, and you can set your tent up really nicely there, right? Versus out in the middle of nowhere and you're trying to cut your own down, right? And create your own shelter from nothing. Two very different types of camping. And so we're still camping because we dwell in tents. On this earth, we dwell in tents. And that's the point he's making here. But he says, "But we know that if this tent is destroyed, we have a building from God." That building, by the way, does not mean temporary dwelling, but a permanent dwelling. So two different terms. You and I have temporary dwellings. And the only permanent dwelling we have prepared for us is the one God has made. And he said, it is a house not made with hands that is eternal in the heavens. I asked somebody years ago, I told this story a while back. I don't remember where, if it was at a men's breakfast or something. I had was in a meeting, kind of a business meeting with Chamber of Commerce people. And a realtor had asked, who wants, their ideal home, your dream home. Who could have your dream home? It's like, okay, she was asking everybody what their dream home was. And I said, do you have a home that needs no maintenance? That never has to have anything be done to it? That would be my dream home. That's the one God just described here, by the way. There isn't any like that in this world. Every home, the nicest home you'll ever buy, will need maintenance. And you'll have to take care of it. And you'll have to pay to fix it and repair it and maintain it. And when it breaks, fix it again if you live in it long enough. Because that's what homes are. They're temporary abodes in this world. But God has promised us a home that is eternal. That it was not made with people's hands. I assume he's telling us that God spoke it into existence like he did and created everything else. But he says, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened. Not that we would be unclothed, but that we would be further clothed. So that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. He who has prepared for us for this very thing is God, who has given us a spirit as a guarantee. So we are always of good courage, he said. We know that while we're at home in the body, we are away from the Lord. For we walk by faith and not by sight. Yes, we are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. Is that statement really true? I think we need to ask ourselves that. Do you really believe that you will be happier when you're not in your body anymore? That is important. And when you're pushed and when you're threatened with that very thing happening is when you find out whether you really believe it or not. Demas, I assume Demas would have thought he had that. And then when he got faced with it, he didn't. And so we have to look at ourselves and judge ourselves and be honest about ourselves and find out, are we weak? Are we loving this world a little too much? Or are we loving the idea of what God has said he would made for us? And so he says, we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we're at home or away, we make it our aim to please him. We'd rather be there than here. But whether we're here or whether we're there, our goal is to please God. And he says, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. Now, I'm going to give you a little story to kind of finish this up. And I'm going to give you a story of a martyr from 203 A.D. The woman named Perpetua, she's a fairly famous martyr. Perpetua was about 22 years old with a nursing infant. She was a noble woman from a noble family, not Christians. She became a Christian by a brother, I'm trying to remember the exact name here, Satyrus was her instructor who taught her about Christ. And in 2002, the Emperor Septimus Severus, which you got to stop thinking about Harry Potter now. Because as soon as I said that, I'm thinking, okay, a bunch of people who are all into Harry Potter are going to start, when you hear Severus, you're all thinking about Harry Potter. So get that out of your head now. So this emperor, he disallowed conversions to Christianity. In the wake of that act, severe persecution broke out against Christians, particularly in North Africa. And living in Carthage at this time is Perpetua. And she was in the process of being baptized, going through kind of studies. And so this is her own words. While we were still under arrest, my father, out of love for me, was trying to persuade me and shake my resolution. Father, I said, do you see this vase here, for example, or water pot or whatever? He said, yes, I do. Said he, and I told him, could it be called by any other name than what it is? And he said, no. Well, so too, I cannot be called anything other than what I am, a Christian. At this, my father was so angered by the word Christian that he moved toward me as though he would pluck my eyes out. But he left it at that and departed, vanquished along with his diabolical arguments. Then Tertius and Pomponius, those blessed deacons who tried to take care of us, bribed soldiers to allow us to go to a better part of the prison to refresh ourselves for a few hours. Everyone then left that dungeon and shifted for himself, I nursed my baby, who was faint from hunger. In my anxiety, I spoke to my mother about the child. I tried to comfort my brother, and I gave the child into their charge. I was in pain because I saw them suffering out of pity for me. These were the trials I had to endure for many days. Then I got permission for my baby to stay with me in prison. At once I recovered my health. Relieved as I was of my worry and anxiety over the child, my prison had suddenly become a palace so that I wanted to be there rather than anywhere else. Then my brother said to me, "Dear sister, you are greatly privileged. Surely you must ask for a vision to discover whether you are to be condemned or freed." She did this, by the way, and it's described that she saw a vision. I'm not going to read it all for time this morning, but her teacher comes to her in the vision, climbing a ladder up to heaven, and a great dragon is trying to kill them. And he said, "Be careful, don't be, you know, eaten by the dragon. And don't let dragon bite you." She says she won't, that dragon won't harm her. She steps on the dragon's head and begins to climb the ladder. And then she came into a garden, and a gray-haired man sat at a shepherd's garb, who was tall and milking sheep, and standing around him were many thousands of people clad in white garments. He raised his head, looked at me, and said, "I'm glad you have come home, my child." He called me over to him and gave me, as it were, a mouthful of the milk he was drawing. And I took it in my cupped hands and consumed it. And all those who stood around said, "Amen." At the sound of this word, I came to with the taste of something sweet still in my mouth. I at once told my brother, and we realized that we would have to suffer. And that from now on, we would no longer have any hope in this life. And a few days later, there was a rumor there was going to be a hearing. My father arrived from the city, worn with worry. He came to me with the idea of persuading me. "Daughter," he said, "have pity on my gray head. Have pity on me, your father. If I deserve to be called your father, if I have favored you above all your brothers, if I have raised you to reach this prime of your life, do not abandon me to be the reproach of men. Think of your brothers. Think of your mother and your aunt. Think of your child." How many 22-year-old women would bow to the pressure knowing they have a nursing child? And so we wouldn't probably think of a woman who gave in and said, "Oh, I'm not a Christian," in that circumstance. We probably wouldn't be terribly harsh with her. And yet it's not what God would ask of her. It's not what God would ask of any of us. And so her father is persuading her and pressuring her. And he says, "Who will not be able to live once you are gone?" He basically says, "Think of your child who will not be able to live once you are gone. Give up your pride. You will destroy all of us. None of us will ever be able to speak freely again if anything happens to you." This was the way my father spoke out of love for me. Kissing my hands, throwing himself down before me, I tried to comfort him, saying, "It will all happen in the prisoner's dock as God wills. For you may be sure that we are not left to ourselves, but are all in his power." And he left me in great sorrow. One day while we were eating breakfast, we were suddenly hurried off for a hearing before Hilarionus, the governor. All others, when questioned, admitted their guilt. Then when it came my turn, my father appeared with my son, dragged me from the step and said, "Perform the sacrifice. Have pity on your baby." Hilarionus, the governor, said to me, "Have pity on your father's gray head. Have pity on your infant son. Offer the sacrifice for the welfare of the emperors." Those are the sacrifices to the Roman gods. She says, "I will not." "Are you a Christian?" he said. She said, "Yes, I am." When my father persisted in trying to dissuade me, Hilarionus ordered him to be thrown to the ground and beaten with a rod. Felt sorry for my father, just as if I myself had been beaten. Then Hilarionus passed sentence on all of us. We were condemned to the beasts, and we returned to prison in high spirits. Now, I'm going to end with just a couple more passages. I'm leaving out a whole bunch more. Because an observer writes down how she died before the beasts. The day of their victory dawned. They marched from the prison to the amphitheater joyfully as though they were going to heaven. with calm faces, trembling, if at all, with joy rather than fear. Perpetua went along with shining countenance and calm step as the beloved of God, as a wife of Christ, putting down everyone's stare by her own intense gaze. They were then led to the gates, and the men were forced to put on the robes of priests of Saturn, the women in the dress of the priestess of Ceres. But the noble Perpetua strenuously resisted this to the end. We came to this of our own free will, that our freedom should not be violated. We agreed to pledge our lives, provided that we would do no such thing. You agreed with us to do this. And so they took it away, took away those garments. Now, after some more, I'm going to leave out some of the descriptions of what happened to them. They have a mad cow attack them. She got up after being thrown around by the cow. Hair or the clothes have been ripped and torn, and she stood up and seen Felicitas, one of her slaves, who is also a Christian, who is dying, who is being thrown in with her, has been crushed to the ground. She went over to her, gave her hand, and lifted her up. And then the two stood side by side. By the cruelty of the mob was now appeased, so they were called back through the gate of life. Perpetua then called for her brother and spoke to him together with the catechumens and said, "You must all stand fast in the faith and love one another." Do not be weakened by what we have gone through. Immediately as the contest was coming to a close, a leopard was let loose. After one bite, Satyrus, guy who had taught her, was dead or drenched in blood. Shortly afterward, he was thrown unconscious with the rest in the usual spot to have his throat cut. But the mob asked that their bodies be brought out into the open. So the martyrs got up and went to the spot of their own accord. And kissing one another, they sealed their martyrdom with a ritual kiss of peace. The others took the sword in silence and without moving. Especially Satyrus, who, being the first to climb the stairway, was the first to die. For once again, he was waiting for Perpetua. Perpetua, however, had yet to taste more pain. She screamed as she was struck on the bone. Then she took the trembling hand of the young gladiator and guided it to her throat. It was as though so great a woman could not be dispatched unless she herself was willing. It's hard to read, right? Probably hard to listen to. But it's what a 22-year-old woman did out of faith for Christ. Overcame the fear, even for her own child. Right? Her father telling her, "Your child's going to die." But don't you think she knew that? Is it a shame that her child would die? No. That's gain too. We forget that. So the courage, the strength to overcome all that she did is what you and I are called to. And as we read about, like in Hebrews chapter 11, all the martyrs who have gone before us, whom we stand kind of in their witness, it's for us. We may not be called upon this, and I hope we never have to, but we have to be able to. We have to stand in the fear of whatever is confronted by, to be faithful to God to the very end. Now, part of why I'm crying so much is thinking about Julie as well. But it's hard to talk about death at the moment of my life. So, but I appreciate all of your time here this morning. We're going to end there, and next week we'll be on to a new subject. But I appreciate all of your attention for the last, few weeks, and I hope you think a lot about the idea of facing fear and facing fear in a way that you respond to it out of godliness and righteousness, courage and strength, and don't let it overwhelm you and don't let it overcome you. So Well, then we'll stop there. We have a song selected that we're going to sing. And that should be up here soon, I assume. There we go. We're going to be Sing to Me of Heaven. And hopefully, just as we close out, though, just a reminder that we always want to help those who are in need in any way. And if you're here and you need anything, please reach out to us. Let us know how we can serve you, how we can help you. Let's go ahead and stand and sing.